wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Weezy Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome, listeners, to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. In this hour, We the People, I'm your host, David Whetstone, and I am so happy that you, the listener, decide to sponsor this station. You've done so for 46 years, providing jazz and justice. And we're going to follow those lines in this broadcast. Our subject today is the arc of truth in the life and thinking of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest is cultural historian Louis V. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is professor emeritus of religious studies at Vanderbilt University, which is in Nashville, Tennessee. He is the author of There is a Bomb in Gilead, The Cultural Roots of Martin Luther King Jr., To Make the Wounded Whole, The Cultural Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., and Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prologue of Luther King Jr., followed by his latest book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Baldwin has spent most of his adult life being a King scholar, and he's well known in religious study circle for a degree of expertise that is totally unique. Dr. Baldwin, good morning, and thank you for being with us this morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, we should get right to it. It's such an honor to have you here with us this morning. Can you first begin to tell the listeners how you decided to dedicate most of your work in life to the study of Dr. King?
Well, I guess when I started seminary back in the early 70s, I had had some exposure to the civil rights movement in high school, college. And during my seminary years, I had a course on the life and thought of Martin Luther King Jr. I was at Colgate Rochester Divinity School, Bexley Hall Crozer Seminary at that time, 1971 to 75. And I had a course on Dr. King. And of course, a number of courses on the social gospel. And that reinforced my interest in Dr. King. So after I finished seminary, I matriculated at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. I pursued a PhD in American Religious Studies, and my interest in Dr. King grew. And it was during my pursuit of the PhD degree that I decided to write articles on Dr. King. And from that point, after receiving the PhD in 1980, I decided to devote my life to King studies and King scholarship.
I don't want to waste a minute to spare, to be quite honest. So we're talking about a particular aspect of Dr. King that I believe most scholars in the public square neglect, and that is the matter of truth. And I would like you to give at least a preliminary definition or finding of how you grab the concern of truth with Dr. King.
Well, Dr. King understood truth as a legitimate extension of the facts and of reality. And we know that he grew up in a household in Atlanta, Georgia, and in a church tradition that attached supreme value to truth, truth telling, and truth sharing. Dr. King's father, as you well know, Martin Luther King Sr., was a pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, and he proclaimed truth from the pulpit and acted on truth daily in terms of his involvement in the struggle against segregation. So Dr. King grew up in that kind of environment, a church tradition, an extended family tradition in which truth was considered a supreme value. And he also grew up with a questioning attitude toward life. We have to remember that he grew up in the midst of a Jim Crow culture. And he was always raising questions about why such a social order. And he was told by his parents when he was still in elementary school that segregation was a social order, but not a natural order. But he said from that point, from about age six on, he had this questioning attitude toward life, and he was determined to know truth.
Your book informs us, and you said it just now,
that his family life reinforced this commitment, this conviction.
Uh-huh.
Martin Luther King Sr., sometimes probably known as Daddy King, pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, was no shrinking violet in Atlanta in a time where there was fierce and ferocious oppression.
Yeah.
If I'm recollecting correctly from your book,
mm-hmm.
he witnessed his father even chastising a policeman not to call him boy.
Yes.
And his father, along with his maternal grandfather, were involved in various Black civic organizations throughout the Atlanta area, including
yes.
the NAACP.
Yeah.
Could you say just even a little bit more about this kind of early formative experience of Dr. King?
Well, I think we have to keep in mind his education. We've talked about family and the church tradition. But in the very early years in elementary school at Yonge Street Elementary School in Atlanta, Dr. King was exposed to a number of preachers and teachers who stressed the importance of truth and truth-telling. Truth-telling about Black history, truth-telling about life and what it meant to grow up in a segregated or Jim Crow society. So he had teachers, and he was surrounded by preachers and other success symbols that talked to him constantly about truth and truth telling. So you have to take into account his early education. When he got to Morehouse at age 15 in 1944, one of the administrators at Morehouse described Dr. King as an avid truth seeker. And of course, he was in his teens at that time. So education was important. The family church tradition were very, very important. And I think we have to take into account experiential factors. The fact that he was exposed to brutal oppression in the South. And that too triggered the same kinds of concerns on his part as they related to this pursuit of truth.
So you're clearly demonstrating that he extended an unafraid, unabashed, even I would dare say rightful nature of inquiry, unafraid mm-hmm. to ask questions in Sunday school,
yeah.
unafraid to ask questions throughout his early education, unafraid once he gets to college.
Yeah.
The book seems to indicate, as well as other scholars have, that this proclivity of asking questions kind of marked Dr. King as, let's use a fancy term, a dialectical thinker. In other words, the purpose of asking a question was indeed to seek the truth.
That's right.
Again, help us out as listeners, Dr. Baldwin. What's a preliminary or functioning sense of the truth that you want us to keep in mind?
Well, truth as absolute. Dr. King had in mind objective truths, truths that are universally acceptable, that are verifiable. He often said that God is absolute truth, and that there are certain objective truths that we have to accept because they are universal, they are verifiable. So that's very, very important. But we know that he spoke of different kinds of truths, experiential truths, biblical truths, theological truths, philosophical truths. So he understood that there are different categories of truth, but truth is truth. It is the legitimate extension of the facts and of reality. This is how we understand truth.
It's said that he looked anywhere and everywhere, not willy-nilly, not in terms of itching ears or anxiousness, but a deliberate discipline practice of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, I'm trying to be a little bit careful here, but you and other scholars have talked about a sense of King's rejection of biblical fundamentalism. What's meant by that?
Yes, well, Dr. King was exposed very early, as you well know, to what he called unlettered teachers who were fundamentalists, biblical fundamentalists, and of course his own parents were biblical fundamentalists. But given his early questioning attitude toward life, He was uncomfortable with biblical fundamentalism when he denied the physical resurrection of Jesus at 12 years old. He said, I shocked my Sunday school class. But I think that speaks to this questioning attitude toward life. The physical resurrection of a person did not make sense to him. And of course, he raised the question in that context. Does it really make sense? And we see him even at age 12 struggling with biblical truths. And later, of course, he at age 18, when he was before his ordination committee, becoming a preacher at that time, he denied the virgin birth. So he had problems with certain biblical fundamentals, the physical resurrection of Jesus, the virgin birth, a literal hell during those early years. And this is why when he left Morehouse, he had pretty much rejected fundamentalism in favor of theological liberalism and biblical liberalism.
So that branch of theology is known to be very analytical and very critical in a scholarly sense.
Well,
you go ahead, sir.
Well, Dr. King considered philosophical theology as the best path to truth. As you well know, his PhD was in systematic theology, but he also claimed philosophical theology because the philosophical life, he felt, was very important. So is the theological life when one is interested in the pursuit of truth. And this is why he very early had an interest in both philosophy and theology. But before that, he majored in sociology at Morehouse. And as you well know, social science methodology is about what? Collecting facts and data to establish truths about human affairs. So you can see throughout those early years, Morehouse, later Crows of Boston, he's studying sociology, he's studying philosophy and theology because he realizes that these are paths to truth.
So people with this gem of knowledge know that for Dr. King, in many regards, it all started with Plato.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of his affinities? Who were the people? What was the thought that he was engaging?
Well, he felt that Plato had come up with certain truths about the love ethic, for an example. Based on Plato's dialogue, King had come to the idea of love as eros, romantic love, love as philia, brotherly love, and agape love, as you well know, which is the highest form of love, unconditional love for all people. So he felt that Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, all of these early philosophers were interested in not only getting at reality, but also understanding truth. What is truth? And it is the highest good, according to these earliest philosophers, as Dr. King understood them. So he not only studied now the early Greek philosophers, but also the ancient Hebrew prophets, as you well know, because he felt that in the case of both the philosophers and the prophets, the goal was to understand truth, to pursue truth, and to understand truth. Not to come to some final understanding of truth, because the understanding of that King had is that this is an endless search. But he began that search with a study of the ancient Greek philosophers and the ancient Hebrew prophets.
And just to fill out the picture, let me first reintroduce you and help our listeners get our bearings, talking about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our guest this morning is cultural historian Louis B. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at Vanderbilt University. He is the author of There is a Bomb in Gilead, The Cultural Roots of Martin Luther King Jr., To Make the Wounded Whole, The Cultural Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Never to Leave Us Alone, The Prayer Life of Martin Luther King Jr., and the recently released The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King. That is our topic of discussion. Dr. Baldwin has said, Martin Luther King Jr. said and wrote as much or more about the meaning, nature, power of truth than any other prominent figure in the 1950s and the 1960s. King was not only vastly influential as an advocate for and a defender of truth, he also did more than anyone in his time to organize truth into a movement for liberation, uplift, and empowerment of humanity, efforts that ultimately resulted in the loss of his life. Mm-hmm. Dr. Bowen, you further continued and said that truth derives from a revolution in the heart, mind, and soul before it can be translated into institutions and structures that guarantee freedom, justice, human dignity, equality of opportunity, and peace.
Yes, sir.
And so now the listeners know what we're about in this hour. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Let's, you know, it's a shame to sometimes be so linear in a discussion, but yeah. I want to get as much from you for the benefit of our listeners as possible. Let's remember Dr. King's other inspirations, not only the Hebrew prophets and Jesus, but Thoreau and Gandhi. Can you tell us about the last two in particular?
Yes. Dr. King actually studied Jesus before he studied Gandhi and Thoreau. And he found much in Gandhi and Thoreau that sort of reinforced what he had gotten from his study of Jesus. He read the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, the fifth chapter of St. Matthew, love your enemies, turn the other cheek. But when he got to Thoreau, he got a philosophical understanding of what that meant. And also with Gandhi, because both speak of the love ethic. In fact, Dr. King claims that its first intellectual contact with nonviolence came through his reading of Henry David Thoreau, and later Gandhi, of course. But we have to understand that he first read Jesus. And because of what he had gotten from his reading of Jesus, about Jesus in the New Testament, he was receptive to what he got from Thoreau and Gandhi around this question of what is love and how to translate love into nonviolent action. And Gandhi and Thoreau taught him a lot about that, how to actually translate the love ethic into nonviolent action, civil disobedience, acts of civil disobedience, etc. So this is very, very important.
And I was intrigued by your exploration and examination of the Gandhi interest, particularly around the notions of truth. Can you just convey what a reader of your book might find out about that?
About Gandhi?
Yes, and particularly the notion of truth as King studied Gandhi.
Well, we have to look at Gandhi's concept of satyagraha, which means truth is equal to love, force, or justice. So you have to draw that connection between truth, love, and justice. And Dr. King, as the same as Gandhi, said that there's an interrelationship here that we have to take into account. In other words, there is an intimate relationship between truth, love, power, justice. Love, power, and justice are dimensions of truth. Dimensions of the activity of truth, if I might put it that way. They are also attributes of God. Dr. King made it clear that when he spoke of love, power, justice, that he was actually talking about attributes of God and also dimensions of the activity of God.
You have said in your book, and I think I've heard somewhere, that for Martin Luther King, love, power, and justice are a creative union.
Mm-hmm.
So power at its best is love implementing the demands of justice.
Yeah. And love at its best is justice at its best is love speaking against anything that stands against love. So here again, and we have to take into account the impact of Paul Tillich there too, because the philosophical theologian Paul Tillich has written a book called Love, Power, and Justice. And Dr. King had read that book. And he understood that you really can't separate the three, that there's a creative union there, that love, power, and justice are expressions of the activity of God. And you simply can't separate the three.
with that in mind, I'm going to reintroduce you and signal to our control room that we'll probably take an earlier than normal break for our public service announcements.
Okay.
So let me do the bridge here and tell listeners, if you stick with We the People right here on your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, you're going to find out how Dr. King took his pursuit of truth with an active dynamic life and affected the world outside the bounds of the church, outside of the parameters that have historically evolved and have limited him. And so on this occasion, we not only celebrate Dr. King, but we thank Dr. Lewis Baldwin, who's the cultural historian who's written The Arc of Truth, for his good work. Dr. Baldwin, you are very adroit in your writing. You gave us a bridge, and I'll just use it here. Only a few months after receiving his PhD, he, Dr. King, was launched into civil rights leadership in December of 1955. And so we'll continue from that point onward. I'm going to ask listeners to stick with us. You're listening to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. The program is We the People, and we'll be right back after these announcements.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration, on Friday, April 25th, from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
And with a heartfelt conviction of thanking you for keeping such a station as WPFW in existence, both by your financial wherewithal, but also with your social connectivity and supporting us. We're here with Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin. He is a King scholar, pretty well known in the field, sir. Thank you. You've done some hard work over many, many years.
Thank you, sir.
And we're focusing our conversation through the subject of his book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. As I said before the break, we really can confirm King's commitment and meaningful pursuit of the truth by talking about his public life. Mm-hmm. And I made the bridge to December 1955. What's beginning to happen with Dr. King? Again, he's freshly PhD'd. He's got his doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
Where is he going to? What responsibilities does he take up? And what does he encounter, sir?
Well, we know that in December 1955, by that time, Dr. King had preached a lot about truth. He had written about truth. But when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat, he was catapulted to leadership in the Montgomery movement. And at that point, he said, I had to learn how to translate the truths I'd learned in the philosophies and universities and seminaries into practical action and practical reality. And he was able to do that through the civil rights movement. He saw the civil rights movement from the very beginning in Montgomery as going to battle for truth. He often talked about truth marching on, which meant, of course, that the civil rights movement was about living truth and acting on truth, not simply exposing the truth about America, but also advancing certain truths, truths about what America should become, calling America back to her declaration of self-evident truths in the Constitution and Declaration of Independence. So at that point, he had, in Montgomery, had become not simply a proclaimer of truth, but one who was, had begun to act on truth through civil disobedience and nonviolence and boycotts, other forms of nonviolent direct action.
But there's a price to that, and sometimes you pay the price in a quiet place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm alluding to, and you were smiling, he had a kitchen table experience in the middle of the night.
That's right.
What was this kitchen table experience?
Well, he received a call at midnight one night, I think it was January 1956. He received a call from a white supremacist who threatened his life, telephone call, threatened his life, threatened to blow up his home, threatened his family. And he said for the first time, he felt deep fear. He didn't know what to do. He thought about all of the philosophy and theology he had studied in the universities and seminaries, trying to come up with philosophical and theological reasons for evil, some understanding of that kind of evil. But he said the answer didn't come at that point from philosophy and theology. And then he bowed over a cup of coffee and said a prayer. And he said he prayed to God for courage in the face of bigotry and intolerance and racism. And he said he had a vision as a result of that prayer. And the Holy Spirit came to him and said, look, keep standing up for justice and for truth. And lo, I will be with you even unto the end of the world. It was an epiphany. It was a vision, a religious experience, something of a conversion experience. And I think it was at that point that Dr. King understood his role as a prophet, that he had to stand up for truth in spite of the risk, even at the risk of his life. And so from that point, from that the time of that vision in the kitchen in 1956, he said, I had no longer experienced that kind of fear because I always had this sense of divine companionship, that God was with us in the movement, that God would stand with us in the movement. And God, after all, is the source of all truth, all courage. So I had no reason after that kitchen experience to really fear, not even to fear death.
You say in your narrative at this juncture, you take the choosing of describing Dr. King as the ethical prophet.
Yeah.
And as a reader of your book, there was a gladness of heart at your strong affirmation. So yeah. If you can tell the listeners why this notion of the ethical prophet, particularly since we've introduced it by way of the kitchen table experience, why is it so critical in a good understanding, a good comprehension of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.?
We have to understand now, go back to the Bible, because Dr. King saw himself standing in the tradition of the Old Testament prophets, or the Hebrew Bible prophets, Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, who were mouthpieces for God. They told God's truths to the people. And Dr. King saw himself in that light, standing in that prophetic tradition that extends back to the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. Also that prophetic tradition that extends back in the Black church tradition, with figures like Richard Allen and Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. He was a part of that prophetic tradition as well. And if you're going to be an ethical prophet, you have to be willing to speak truth to power and evil in high places. You have to understand the moral obligation to speak truth to power. And this is what an ethical prophet is. This is what an ethical prophet does. Dr. King said, and we see this in his outspokenness on Vietnam, many of his co-workers and many in his family had said, look, if you take on this issue, it's very dangerous. You could be assassinated. But Dr. King nonetheless decided that he would speak out against U.S. involvement in Vietnam. He would attack capitalism. He would call for a radical redistribution of economic resources in the interests of the poor. And all of this is revolutionary. But the ethical prophet must be true to power and must take on all social evils, irrespective of the threats to his well-being and his life.
So as you've demonstrated in your book, truth and freedom are inseparable in King's own scales of values.
Yeah.
When we get to preaching, he preached, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free," John 8, verse 32. One of his favorite verses, I believe.
Yeah.
So, in one regard, there is an open license, most of King's life, an open sense of support from people who look like him.
Yeah.
Within the doors of the church and the various communities that he was involved in. But by his very nature, he's challenging America. What was King's message strategy?
King's message strategy was to speak to the evils of society, to expose those evils, and to call America back to her democratic creed. To say to America, be true to what you said on paper. Be true to what you said in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. He had the Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other. And he called upon America to be true to both. You say that you stand in the democratic tradition. Be true to what you said in your founding documents. You say that you are part of Judeo-Christian culture. Be true to what you say when you quote scripture. So that was Dr. King's messaging strategy. I think it is reflected very well in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail, where he challenges America to really be true to her democratic creed and her Judeo-Christian creed. And I think that was essentially his messaging strategy.
Without any dilution, I just want to strategically reiterate at your prompting that the important triad of extra-biblical documents were the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Yeah.
Throughout his speeches, it would do one well to note those times where he draws on those documents.
Yeah.
I want to deliberately utilize the whole hour, but I want to say at this point in our progression, he's talking to the broadest audiences while challenging white Christians to take what he's doing, his being, the activities around him deeply and seriously. There's a striking contrast of those who make a religious claim who are against them and Dr. King's wonderful, eclectic global internationalism. We've already demonstrated that he was well aware of Gandhi and other traditions. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marched with him. Other notable leaders did too as well. Can you talk a little bit about the challenge to white Christians, but also maybe dare to compare or contrast that to the response of the religious community at large?
Yes, Dr. King said to white Christians, and we see this in the letter from the Birmingham City Jail, that you need to go back to a sense of the prophetic as reflected in the early church. The early Christians would not go to war. They would not bow down to Caesar. They would not accept the status quo. They would not worship the status quo. So he called upon white Christians to go back to the principles that you say you hold dear, scripture. You say that you are part of the Bible Belt here in the South. What does the Bible say to us about love and justice and freedom? We need to go back to those concepts, he said to white Christians. And I think that was his message to the Christian community as a whole, to the Christian world, is that we need to be clear about what Christianity means, that love is central to the Christian faith, that Jesus said over and over that we should love our neighbors. as ourselves, that we should love God, that we can't love God unless we first love the neighbor. So he was calling all Christians back to a sense of what the gospel is, what the true gospel is, the gospel of love, the gospel of peace, the gospel of reconciliation, forgiveness, and community. This is what I think his challenge to all Christians was about. And we have to keep in mind, you mentioned Rabbi Heschel and Mohandas K. Gandhi. Dr. King believed in pan-religious dialogue. He believed that truths are conveyed through all religions to some extent. And so he felt that learning about other religions provided an opportunity for growth from him, for him. That when we study other religions, they provide opportunities for learning, for growth, also for our cooperative concrete activism in the interest of human liberation and empowerment. And we know that Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement intersected Protestants and Catholics and Jews, all marching for freedom, for the same goal. They are different. They have different belief systems in some sense, but this common goal of human liberation and empowerment. So he called for pan-religious dialogue and also pan-religious cooperation. Cooperation between Christians, but also between Christians and peoples of other faith traditions. That we all have to work together if we're going to have a world that's peaceful, if we're going to have a world in which people are respected for their personhood, human dignity, community, reconciliation. All of these values are important, and we must pursue them through pan-religious cooperation.
And it's no contradiction that in operating within his own identity, his own tradition, the cross, its event, and its actuality became increasingly significant for Dr. King, both symbolically and literally. Mm-hmm. And you say that in your book.
Yeah.
What did the cross symbolize regarding truth for Dr. King?
Well, Dr. King talked a lot about bearing the cross of truth. And he saw Christ on the cross as bearing the cross of truth. But through the resurrection, Christ what? Shows the triumphant quality of truth. The resurrection is about truth triumphing over untruth.
So both the truth crucified and the truth victorious, as you say in your book.
Yes, yes. The cross is both a truth carried, a truth on the shoulders of the prophet, as well as truth ultimately becoming triumphant over untruth. And that has to be kept in mind. So Dr. King spoke of the cross in symbolic terms and also in literal terms. He went back to the Bible, talked a lot about Jesus bearing the cross and what that meant, but also in more symbolic terms, what that cross means for all human beings who are willing to be truthful, to engage in truth telling and truth sharing. That cross has a meaning for us all.
The ultimate demonstration of love in action.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's the ultimate demonstration of what love is, what justice is, what truth is. And that's very, very important.
With this conviction and his determination to spread that and have other people take it up, he urged people to become the maladjusted. What is meant by being the maladjusted?
Well, Dr. King said maladjusted is a word that psychologists use to show, to describe people who don't adjust socially to society. But he said, I don't want to adjust to segregation. There's certain things I don't want to adjust to. I want to remain maladjusted to. I don't want to ever adjust to economic injustice. I want to remain maladjusted. And a word he used also interchangeably with that is nonconformity, is what he was talking about. I don't ever want to conform to the status quo as it relates to racial injustice and economic injustice and war. I want to remain maladjusted. I want to be a nonconformist, because you don't adjust to evil. You remain maladjusted in the face of evil. You remain a nonconformist in the face of evil. Jesus, he said, was maladjusted. He was a nonconformist. He refused to bow to Caesar. He refused to support war. He refused to sanction hatred and bigotry. He remained maladjusted or a nonconformist in that regard.
You are a very skillful user of quotes. If you allow me, this will kind of further the point and push us forward. Mm-hmm. You quote Dr. King, "History still has a choice place for those who have the moral courage to be maladjusted.
Yeah.
The salvation of the whole world lies in the hands of the maladjusted. The challenge to use to be maladjusted as the prophet Amos,
yeah,
who in the midst of the injustices of his day would cry out in the words that echoed across centuries, 'Let judgment run down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.'" Yeah. Martin Luther King in the essay, "The Cause of the Maladjusted," 1956. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So very early in his particular juncture, in his particular journey, again, he's spreading his conviction, his commitment, and his solidarity with other human beings throughout the world.
Yeah.
Listeners, I'm going to remind you that we're talking with Dr. Louis V. Baldwin. Dr. Baldwin is a King scholar and cultural historian of American religion. His latest book is The Ark of Truth, and it's subtitle, "The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr. That is the engine of our conversation." Mm-hmm. Dr. Baldwin, thank you again for being so much with us.
Thank you.
You make our programming special in our commemoration of Dr. King. I'm going to finish up my house duties here with the station and say, listeners, it's because you, the listener, have supported this station. Every time you go to WPFWFM.org, click that red donate button, you empower a terrific array of programming that supports jazz and justice for well over 46 years. I'll give you one example and we'll get back to our conversation. At 1 p.m. today, Eastern Time, Africa Now with host Moise Mutale talks of African descended people, not only in the continent, but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora. You find out about things like how the arts support environmental concerns in Malawi. That's today's episode of Africa Now. Every noontime, we give you the jazz or music part of things by having you not forget the blues. Don't forget the blues. It's my pleasure to always introduce Clarence the Blues Man Turner, who immediately follows the news after this program. All that and more, I thank you, listeners, for supporting this station for over 46 years. Dr. Baldwin, two charges. I am going to limit myself because we really want to hear two concerns from you. Mm-hmm. I'll start by saying that you've made it clear that Dr. King's courage and commitments and work cost him dearly. We've referred people to the speech regarding the war in Vietnam at Riverside Church a year before his assassination. Yeah. We've referred from the letter from the Birmingham City Jail. Mm-hmm. We'll probably mention in some way his address regarding the Memphis sanitation worker strike.
Yes.
And his sermon there. Mm-hmm. So I will compress the question because we'll have about 5 minutes or so, mm-hmm, at best. Movements advance truth. That's what King was about. He was assaulted on all fronts, mass media, white supremacists, government officials, and the like.
Mm-hmm.
I would be wrong if I didn't leave you and ask, what is it in this moment that you want us to draw upon in the work and life of Dr. King? It's just that simple a question.
Yes. I would want people to understand as they read this book and think of Dr. King that truth matters. And that's important in the culture in which we live today, because we are rapidly becoming an anti-truth-telling culture. And Dr. King reminds us that truth always matters. We have to get back to truth-telling and truth-sharing. If we're going to survive on a solid moral and spiritual foundation as a society, if we're going to remain a civilized society, if we're going to model what a civilized society means, we got to get back to a truth-telling culture. Many scholars are saying today that we live in a post-truth age where lying occurs routinely, that lying has become the norm and not simply a deviation from the norm. So Dr. King reminds us that we have to have the kind of values-laden culture that encourages, that not only encourages and cherishes truth and truth-telling, but that demands truth and truth-telling. And this is what I would hope that readers would get from the book. This is what I would hope that we would will understand as we remember Dr. King on what would have been his 94th birthday, is that truth matters. And if we don't have truth and we don't have truth telling and truth sharing in our society, then we cease to exist on a solid foundation of moral and spiritual values.
Indeed. Would you say that Dr. King would support many of the different efforts that are going on that are indeed inclusive, ecumenical,
yes,
and such?
I think Dr. King would be very much in support of anything that's ecumenical, pan-religious in focus, because he felt that all people of all faith traditions have something to contribute to a better world, to a more peaceful world, to bringing about not only world peace, but world community.
And Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin, with your book, The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King, thank you for really lifting up this important aspect of Dr. King. No longer does he get defanged by the progression of time, but he must be upheld as you have done such. I want to publicly thank you not only for being with us in this hour, but a lot of good, hard, hearty work.
Thank
has,
you.
You've expended with most of your life, I dare say, in us appreciating Dr. King and truth seeking, truth telling, and truth sharing are not passive things. Nonviolence is not passive. It's love in action.
That's right.
And I just wanted to reiterate those points to demonstrate, at least in this hour, I've been a decent student of what you've been saying. Thank you, sir. And I'm sure my listeners thank you.
Thank you for your great questions. They were great questions.
Okay.
Great questions.
All the best to you, sir.
Thank you.
Again, Dr. Lewis V. Baldwin, his book is The Arc of Truth, The Thinking of Martin Luther King Jr.
Yes. And Happy New Year to you.
Yes, thank you. My deep, deep thanks and appreciation, particularly in this show, for the engineering talents and actions of Mike Nasella. It's very much appreciated, along with my thanks to the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, to fellow programmers and staff, thank you. And most importantly, you, the listener, thank you for supporting not only this hour, but those things that delight and empower you, that we build a better world one broadcast at a time, serving the collective need and imagination of you, the community. Thank you. Coming up next is the news, I believe. And hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Take good care in the meantime.
Alliance, WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at wpfwfm.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Are you in the process of writing or updating your will, trust, or estate plan? We invite you to consider adding WPFW as a beneficiary through a charitable bequest. Bequests can take many forms and are usually the largest and most impactful gift a donor will ever make. Your bequest will help to ensure the programming WPFW has provided for almost 50 years will continue into the future. More info available by email at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or by phone at 202-588-0999, extension 344. Or you can let us know you've already included PFW in your plans through those same channels so we can add your name to our growing list of legacy listeners. We are listener supported. We are Jazz and Justice. And because of your support, we are WPFW.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Deya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at wpfwfm.org.
Code Pink Women for Peace is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support Jazz and Justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at wpfwfm.org. Again, that's wpfwfm.org.
Yeah. Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.